This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Welcome to the Tuesday Morning Radio Zine. Up first on Between the Covers, we'll hear an interview with Sharman Apt Russell, author of An Obsession with Butterflies. We are sorry, but we won't have a program mentioned in our listener guide for today. We hope to have that program on feminist literature at a later time. At 9:30, Paige Knight of Hanford Watch will be in to discuss this week's meeting on what will happen with the Hanford Nuclear Reservation and its toxic waste. At 10 o'clock, it's a special documentary called Girls from Cambodia, with firsthand accounts of young Cambodian women speaking frankly about being sold into sexual slavery and escaping their captors. And at 11, on Democracy Now!, hear an interview with a reporter from Time magazine who broke the story about an investigation into allegations that some Marines shot and killed 15 civilians, including 7 women and 3 children, in the Iraqi town of Haditha last November in an apparent act of revenge for the death of a U.S. soldier. And former Republican strategist, Kevin Phillips discusses his new book, American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. Now stay tuned for Between the Covers.
I'm speaking with Sharman Apt Russell. She is the author of several books, including Anatomy of a Rose and When the Land Was Young. She teaches writing at Western New Mexico University and at Antioch University in Los Angeles. Her latest book is An Obsession with Butterflies, Our Long-Lost Love Affair with a Singular Insect. Sharman Apt Russell, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Did you personally have an obsession with butterflies before you wrote this book?
I was working on flowers, and I've always written about nature. So my books all have to do with how I interact with the natural world and how humans do. So I was in the world of pollination ecology. And as I point out in the book, I'm interested in butterflies, but not obsessed to the degree that, you know, some of the people I talk with are.
And can we talk a little bit about that term obsession and how it relates to butterflies? Because it seems that you come at that whole concept from sort of two directions. Am I right?
Right. You know, I'm talking about the different scientists and people and cultures, the Victorian era, the Aztecs. Cultures really through time and across the world have seen in the butterfly a spiritual metaphor. They saw that physical story and resonated with it. But I'm also talking about the life cycle of the butterfly and its obsessions. As a caterpillar, it's obsessions with eating. As a butterfly, it's obsession with mating.
Well, let's start with some examples of the first aspect of obsession that you talked about, perhaps with how people in history, that some the Victorians, for instance. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the examples that you give of Victorians and their own obsession with butterflies.
Well, the Victorian era was a time when the Industrial Revolution was beginning. People looked around and saw kind of a human dominance over nature. The cities were getting dirtier, the factories were proliferating, and to some extent I think they began to mourn what they saw they might be losing. People began collecting nature and putting it in these kind of curio cabinets they had, and butterflies were so collectible. Also, butterflies were very democratic. This wasn't just for the elite. The clerical workers, the people who, you know, would do these studies at night and on the weekends, and they'd rush out to the country, and science was opening up into new ideas. Evolution was in the middle of that century. People were really looking closely at nature in terms of what it was about, but also in terms of their changing relationship to it.
And then you also used ancient Mexico as an example of a time when butterflies became an obsession. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure. The Aztecs saw the butterfly as the representing the soul, or actually being the soul of their sacrificial victims and also warriors killed in battle. And this is so common from certain tribes in Africa to the Aztecs. The Greeks used the word psyche for butterfly and for soul. That physical story of a caterpillar crawling along the ground, stopping, going to sleep, and with quotes around that, and then transforming into a winged creature, you know, the complete change, that sense of total transformation. And in the 5th century, Pope Gelasius I declared Vermis quia resurrexit, the worm has risen. And he was comparing the life of the caterpillar to the life of Christ. So many different religions in so many different time periods have seen it as a metaphor.
Mm-hmm. It probably speaks to the whole importance of transformation as a concept in various cultures.
Right, right. And of the possibility of spiritual transformation from this kind of, you know, a creature low to the earth to something winged. And to something beautiful. I mean, that's something that butterflies, of course, there's all kinds of metamorphosis in the natural world. But butterflies, I think, evoke something in us because we give them the story of beauty. They are beautiful to us. Their colors, their patterns, their flight. Of course, for them, the beauty is just function. And that always interests me, too. It interested me about flowers, that beauty in the natural world is function. And it's that mix that I find compelling.
Yeah, explain how beauty is function for butterflies.
Well, their colors are there to signal to the world. It's a dialogue with the world. One of the things they're signaling is to their predators. Many butterflies have particularly bright, striking colors, and that's kind of like saying, I'm poisonous, don't eat me. It's a big warning sign. Other butterflies aren't poisonous, but they mimic those colors. They want to send the same signal. Butterflies also are communicating to each other, you know, males to females, females to males, males to males, saying, don't come near me, I'm a male, I'm not interested in courting with you. So they live in the daylight more or less, and so their main, and they have wonderful eyesight, better than human eyesight in this range of colors they see. So they are signaling to their enemies and to their friends and to their mates with color, with pattern.
Is it through evolution that they became so beautiful?
Well, yes, exactly. They evolved. Some people think that butterflies evolved to move into the daylight to escape predation by bats, to kind of avoid some of the particular problems they're having as night twilight creatures. And certainly that's one idea. So they evolved to function in the daylight, and thus color and eyesight became a big part of their lives.
Is there, or are there some that you find most beautiful?
You know, the charismatic species for me is the swallowtail. And where I live, it's the two-tailed swallowtail. A little north is the western tiger swallowtail. But you have this gorgeous lemon-yellow butterfly, you know, 3 to 4 inches across, kind of striped with black, and hence the tiger, with little flashes and spots of red and blue. And that's very glamorous. But I have grown a little more sophisticated in my butterfly watching, and it's not just the big charismatic, the swallowtails and the morphos and the things that, you know, are so obvious. But also as I look closer, and it's the tiny hair streaks that when they close their wings and you see their undersides have such delicate patterns and such complicated patterns. It's the tiny blues that when they're closed and they're resting, you wouldn't see them at all. They're camouflaged, and then suddenly they fly up and they're an iridescent blue or a flash of blue. So it's also those smaller kind of unseen butterflies that are beginning to attract me as much.
Uh-huh. And when we talk about smaller, how small are you talking about?
Oh, the blues can be a quarter inch, you know, up to an inch. Really, the thing about butterflies, that kind of secret dimension, is that there are many of them out there, but they're not necessarily, you know, at your eye level or large enough. They're not the whites or the sulfurs or the swallowtails or the painted ladies that you see. They're often the hair streaks and the blues and the smaller butterflies lower down.
I'm speaking with Sharman Apt Russell. We're talking about her book, An Obsession with Butterflies, Our Long-Lost Love Affair with a Singular Insect. Now, how are butterflies viewed in the world of entomologists? How do they think of butterflies? Are they frilly or something? Or
yeah, that's kind of fun. There's about 165,000 species of Lepidoptera and about 18,000 or so are butterflies, and the rest are moths. So butterflies are just a fairly small group of Lepidoptera. Mostly it's moths. One scientist I really enjoyed working with, Martha Weiss, would always rant about how butterflies were not seen as intellectuals. We're not, you know, we're kind of the dummies of the world. They're pretty, they bask, they're after sex, you know, they're stereotyped. And honeybees are seen as the intellectuals. And of course, actually, they do learning experiments. And butterflies can be quite sophisticated. They can learn. So butterflies do have a certain stereotype, according to the entomologist who loved them the most. But of course, like any other insect, they have this incredibly rich and complex life biology.
Right. And how do we know that they're fairly smart?
Well, that's fun to watch scientists try and design experiments that will test butterflies. But what they do is kind of set up situations where a butterfly has to learn, say, a color for nectaring and then a color for egg laying. And so that's two memories for two different activities that the butterfly has to hold. Then they might switch those colors. And then the butterfly has to adjust and learn a new color that represents, yes, this is a good place to stop and drink to nectar. And the butterfly can do that. So the butterfly has a certain flexibility, a certain ability to learn new things. And it has to survive. It's a harsh, difficult world for a butterfly. And so it has to have some flexibility.
You touch on this in your book, but is the butterfly good for anything?
I say at the beginning, I talk about these concepts of use and uselessness, and it's partly about the concepts of beauty and power and the stories we give to the world around us and to the butterfly. And the butterfly is not a great pollinator like the bee or the beetle pollinates a few flowers, but if the butterfly were to disappear, not many flowers or plants would. But, of course, I'm just being playful because the first stage of the butterfly is the caterpillar. And caterpillars, their obsession is to eat the world, and the world is out to eat them. So they feed the world. You know, all the birds out there are looking for caterpillars, you know, for something to eat, and caterpillars are a big part of their diet. Caterpillars are parasitized by all kinds of wasps and flies. Viruses and funguses attack them. So they're all part of that kind of food mill of nature, kind of being ground up. And that's their role. And to some extent, the butterflies that emerge are a kind of a miracle, you know, that they've survived that difficult childhood. And a butterfly will lay hundreds of eggs, and just a few will survive to become butterflies.
You have a passage in the book that it might be a nice time to refer to now that we're going to have you read.
Okay.
It talks about that transformation.
Right. This is just the kind of final, one of the final moments. All this underscores the miracle of what can and does happen regularly. The caterpillar forms a question. The question is answered when a queen, cousin of the monarch, emerges from her chrysalis just before dawn with a swollen-looking body and pathetic, wet, crumpled wings. She needs gravity to help her, and so she climbs to where her wings can hang down as she pumps blood through their veins to expand and harden them. She needs to dispose of waste products, and so she emits a brownish-red fluid. She needs to remove dead cells and skin from her antenna. She needs to zip together the two halves of her proboscis so that it will function as a perfect drinking straw. Tentatively, she moves her head and thorax, which are beautifully patterned, white spots on black. Perceptibly, second by second, she gains strength. Her large wings are a russet orange with a black scallop border. She moves in place, lifting her legs, weighing perhaps a third of what she weighed as a caterpillar. Once she was a stomach attached to a mouth. Now she is designed to float through the air. Her old obsession was food. Her new obsession is mating and laying eggs. In an hour or so, she is ready to fly away. Vermis quia resurrects it.
Just hearing you read that passage makes me wonder about the effect of researching butterflies and writing this book. I mean, did you have to sort of become a butterfly?
I love writing about these things because it does engage me so, you know, more deeply in the place where I live. I happen to live in, southern New Mexico, and so to enter into the world of the species there and the ecology there, and it also engages me with the people working in this field who are so dedicated and who love what they're doing and who are, you know, pursuing minute little research questions. And it's so unworldly. You know, it's not about power and it's not about materialism. It's about, you know, the genitalia of a white cabbage butterfly. And there's something kind of glorious about that, I think. I love peeking into what other people love, and I love being further engaged in the natural world.
I couldn't help thinking a little bit, not necessarily reading the book, but when I saw the concept of the book, if there were any parallels to The Orchid Thief.
I think that idea of obsession, again, it's unworldly. It's not necessarily about money and power, although I think it can be, I guess, with The Orchid Thief that happened a little bit. It's idiosyncratic. It's eccentric. It often is people who become lepidopterist and often do so out of childhood. There's something very pure that happens to them as a child and their love of that kind of fleeting beauty. Of course, I could also say that people love to catalog and people love to name things and people love to collect. I mean, there's that other side to it that's, you know, another part of science.
Right.
That kind of tedious work of proving something and of collecting things and naming them and owning them. So it's big. It involves all that.
Hmm. Now, some passages that sort of sparked kind of in my mind imaginary beautiful images was the chapter when you talked about migrations of butterflies and sort
yes.
of imagining these great migrations of butterflies, what that must have been like. Can you describe a couple of those in history, what happened so that there were these big migrations?
Right. Well, you know, we know of the monarch, which happens every year, and people all over the United States are engaged in that, something called Monarch Watch, where they watch the last summer and early fall generation of monarchs in the Northeast start coming south. It's to a place they've never known, and we really don't know how they know to get there. We know how they navigate more and more, but why that spot? And travel thousands of miles in the millions to reach central Mexico, and they kind of drowse through the winter, and then they start returning in the spring. They don't return all the way. Not one individual, but comes partway. So the monarch is a familiar and glamorous. Painted ladies also migrate, sulfurs migrate, snouts migrate, and they migrate often to escape cold, for example, the painted lady. And so if you have this unusual, high population, you will just see clouds, you know, of the butterflies. In history, there have been years where you had invasions, they called them, you know, of so many painted ladies or so many kinds of species coming.
That must have been so incredible.
I think we're moved, I know I am, by that kind of excess. I think it makes us feel how rich the earth is, how rich our world is when we, you know, whether it's caribou moving or migrate or the migration of butterflies or just that kind of number, excites us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you work at all with the Xerces Society when you did this book?
I corresponded with them a number of times. I was going to visit one of their projects when I went to Costa Rica, but it had been unfortunately disbanded. I've worked a little bit with Robert Michael Pyle. He came in kind of later in part of the book, and it's a wonderful organization, and I'm a member, and you know they do great stuff.
Yeah, because their work, or what I know of their work, makes me aware of the fact that, you know, there are so many things happening with the environment that threaten
Yes. Yeah.
Butterflies.
Yeah, they were involved in the first kind of official labeling of an extinct butterfly, the Xerxes blue. I guess that's how they got their name. And absolutely, habitat loss, and also, of course, our indiscriminate use of pesticides, chemicals. When we spray for mosquitoes, we're spraying for, you know, all kinds of forms of life. I know one tropical lepidoptera says that he writes epitaphs for a living, because as he learns more and more about a certain, you know, part of the ecosystem or in a certain butterfly, he feels it's going to be gone.
Hmm. Yeah. It makes them all the more touching or when we see them. It seems like that makes it all the much more important to kind of stop and contemplate.
It does. And, yeah. You know, I quote from here, a quote from Annie Dillard, we teach our children one thing as we were taught to wake up. And I think that's what I pursue when I'm writing about a subject, is to wake myself up, you know. And I think butterflies wake us up, you know. They're so colorful, and they're so, they draw us, there's, you know, and they're so, you know, they have so much charm, and they wake us up a little, and it's good to kind of go with that, you know, and then watch with, you know, learn more about what the butterfly's doing and what its life is really about, which of course is much more complex than our human story of charm and prettiness.
Right. And they also have a short life.
They have a short life, right? They're fragile. They're ephemeral. The monarchs that do that migration can live as long as 8 or 9 months. Most butterflies live for weeks, would be a good average. But there is this range. There is this diversity. There are postmans and long wings, more the tropics, that live naturally, you know, 8 months and have great memories. They are called our smartest butterflies, you know, and interesting foraging techniques. And
well, I fear the last 3 minutes of that is not going to be coming back to us, so let's go to a little bit of music. Just back announce who we had been listening to before we had the meltdown. It was an interview with Sharman Apt Russell, author of An Obsession with Butterflies. We're sorry that we lost the last 3 minutes of that interview. It's just about 9:25. You're listening to KABU Community Radio, 90.7 FM. Still to come on the radio zine at 10 o'clock, hear a special documentary called Girls from Cambodia, with first-hand accounts of young Cambodian women speaking frankly about being sold into sexual slavery and escaping their captors. Up next, in about 5 minutes, Kathleen Stevenson speaks with Paige Knight of Hanford Watch about this week's meeting on what will happen with the Hanford Nuclear Reservation and its toxic waste.
Hi, Ralph Keyes here. In March of 1971, a new sound went out over the radio in Portland. The station was KABU, and the sound was bluegrass music. Now we're inviting you to a party to help celebrate the 35th anniversary of Music from the True Vine, the longest-running bluegrass show on the West Coast. It's happening on Sunday, April 2nd, starting at 2 p.m. We're having music all day, a chili and cornbread feed, and we'll round out the evening with a swing dance. The KBOO Bluegrass DJs will share MC duties, so if you ever wanted to put a face to those familiar voices, this is your chance. Bands performing will include Jack Straw, Lee Highway, Greg Clark, Kid Mello and the Sleepy Eyed Johns, Little Joe, and the Flat Mountain Girls. A Northwest Fiddle Summit will feature some of the area's greatest fiddlers, and Portland's favorite Western band, The Buckles, will provide music for the evening swing dance. So come on out, 2 p.m. on Sunday, April 2nd at the Wonder Ballroom, 128 North Russell in Portland, for music, chili, dancing, and general celebration. I'll see you there.
Tickets are available at Pioneer Music, Artichoke Music, Wally's Music in Oregon City, at the KBOO office, the Wonder Ballroom box office, and all Ticketmaster outlets.
This spring, KBOO wants to connect you by offering you the opportunity to win your choice of a brand new desktop or laptop computer with a full year of internet service donated by Spirit One. Check your mailbox for the entry form to win KBOO's 2006 Spring Sweepstakes. It's free, it's easy, but you have to enter to win. The deadline for entry is Friday, March 24th at 5 p.m. The winner will be announced on air Saturday, March 25th at noon. If you haven't already received your entry form in the mail, please contact KBOO's membership department. Email membership@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 207. Almost time for KBOO's spring membership drive. If you're able to give a gift of at least $500, consider doubling your money by sponsoring a matching challenge pledge during the drive. You can offer to match every gift during the show of your choice up to the amount you choose. This is a great way to motivate others so we can reach our goal and wrap up the drive early. If you're interested, please contact KBOO's membership coordinator. You can email membership@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 207.
Hey, what's that coming up over yonder?
Well, that's the Bread and Roses, Horses, Women, and Cowgirl Special.
When do you reckon it's going to get here?
On Friday, March 24th, 6 to 7 p.m. Cowgirls in the studio, a horse therapist, and folks calling in with their own horse tales.
Yeehaw!
Friday, March 24th, 6 to 7 p.m. on Bread and Roses.